KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at KBOO.FM. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is Mona Bowen of Film at 11 here on KBOO Portland, and it's time for the spring membership drive. As you know, KBOO is supported by listeners just like you, and because of that, we have access to Democracy Now!, many specialist shows, music of all kinds, and of course, Film at 11, along with an online archive of every show. Becoming a member is easy. Go to KBOO FM and click on the red donate button in the upper right corner and follow the pointers. This spring, any donation up to $12,000 will be matched until the end of May. So please visit KBOO FM and click on the red donate button and help KBOO to continue to serve its listeners, just like you.
Battlefields and self-care, not two things you think of together. American battlefields are centuries removed from their firing cannons, and now they have so much more to offer.
And I think that's a natural evolution. And then so people start coming in for different purposes. And so now we see more visitors at many of these sites from local neighbors walking their dogs as much as people coming to kind of view the history of the site.
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today, protecting our lands and waters and all that dwells within them. But first, it's almost crab season, if the zombies don't get them first. When the Chesapeake Bay oyster fishery was on the verge of collapse, live oysters were brought into the bay from the Gulf of Mexico, but they brought some friends with them, parasites. Amy Fowler is a professor of environmental science and policy at George Mason University. She says the parasites have now created zombie crabs that can't reproduce. Amy, you've been studying crabs that are under attack by a parasite that turns them into what you call zombie crabs. Help me understand what the zombie crab parasite is.
Yes. So this is such a fascinating system. So what we study in our lab are little mud crabs. They're only about the size of your, say, thumbnail. And they are parasitized by a castrating barnacle. And most people know barnacles as those little white things on the shore that kind of mess up your feet and hands. But these guys don't look like barnacles at all. These parasites burrow into the crabs and castrates the crab forever, both male and female crabs, and turns it into a parasite baby-making machine.
How do they castrate the crab?
Yeah, so that's part of the life cycle, which is super fascinating. And only the female barnacle will infect new hosts. And they swim around in the water column, and they're microscopic. You can't see them. And they find a new host and settle down on the outside of the shell. And then they actually inject themselves using kind of similar to like a needle. They inject their genetic material into the crab's blood. And from there, it expands these what we call nutrient rhizoids, which are really similar to kind of the roots of a tree or a plant throughout the entire body of the crab host. It effectively castrates both male and female crabs.
Do male crabs try to mate with these crabs anyway?
That is super fascinating as well. And male crabs that are infected, they behave and morphologically transform into female crabs. The female parasite produces just a reproductive organ outside of the crab, where crabs normally have eggs on their abdomens. And that organ is kind of a beacon to these male parasites that are swimming in the water. And they crawl inside, and there's actually six different parking spaces for six different males inside there. And then the female parasite can actually pick what male she uses to fertilize her eggs with, and then will produce hundreds and hundreds of parasite babies for the rest of the crab's life. The crab never produces crab babies again. It's only parasite babies forever until the crab passes or, you know, dies. But the interesting part about the feminization of the males is that males have a really thin abdomen on the bottom of their, on the underside of their bodies.
Yeah, that's the part that when we're eating a crab, we peel it off, that tall part from the underside?
That's correct. Yep. So that's the abdomen of the crab. Female crabs have an abdomen that looks like the Capitol building. It's like a dome. It's like a half circle. And the reason why they have that is protection, because females will lay eggs and attach that to that, and it protects the eggs from crawling around and being like knocked off and stuff. When the parasite is on the underside of the crab male body, what ends up happening is that that parasite gets scraped up and stuff as the males are moving around. And over time, the abdomen of the crab actually increases to cover and protect the parasite. So it ends up looking like a female instead of a male anymore. And the other really fascinating thing is the behavior changes. So usually, female crabs, if they're not infected, they just have a brood of eggs on the abdomen. They actually move that brood a lot. They'll fluff it out. They'll make sure it's not fouled by any other organisms, like there's nothing growing on top of it. They make sure that the eggs are oxygenated. And then when the larvae are ready to hatch, they actually have a behavior where they stand up, they flap their abdomen, and they help the larvae kind of swim away. What's really cool is that the parasite actually changes the behavior for both males and females to do the same similar behaviors, but for the parasite. So they keep the parasite clean. They make sure the parasite is oxygenated. They make sure that when the parasite is ready to release its larvae, that they stand up on their legs again and they pump that abdomen and they help the larvae be released from the brood chamber.
I have so many questions. Does it hurt the crabs? Can they tell they've got a parasite in them? Is it psychologically depressing to them?
That's a great question. I don't know if there is any kind of research having to do with if crabs can, quote unquote, feel being infected. I mean, the ways that we can look at that are changes in behavior. But in terms of what they feel, I think that's an area of research that we just don't know much about.
What do you think?
I think they don't know, because the parasite is completely intertwined in basically all the organ systems of the crab, including, you know, quote unquote, brains. They don't have the same type of brains we do. I think because it's all intertwined, they don't know. They don't know. They're just completely taken over, completely, by this parasite.
So where did the parasite come from? How long has it been infecting these little tiny mud crabs? And has it hit the crabs we eat the most, the blue crabs that are so prized in restaurants?
Yeah, this parasite is invasive to the Chesapeake Bay and along the southeastern coast of the Atlantic Ocean in North America. The crab is native from Canada all the way down the East Coast, all through the Gulf of Mexico, and all the way down to Veracruz in Mexico. The parasite has only been native in the Gulf of Mexico. And it was introduced, we hypothesize, into the Chesapeake Bay in the 1960s through the aquaculture trade of oysters, when the oyster populations were decreasing in the Chesapeake Bay. They started to bring oysters from other locations to try to seed new populations of oysters. And these little mud crabs love living in oyster reef habitat. That's where they like to get into the nooks and crannies, and there's lots of available habitat for these guys.
Doesn't this always happen? We're always trying to solve one problem and creating another.
Oh, completely. And, you know, that harkens to a lot of other aspects about invasion ecology, you know, the aspect of moving something like firewood across state lines that inadvertently has lots of insect hitchhikers and things like that. So, yeah.
It's interesting, though, that you say this has been going on since the 1960s, and yet the blue crabs are okay.
Right. So this species only affects these tiny mud crabs. However, there is a sister species of the one that we study that infects blue crabs in the Gulf of Mexico.
But there's no way that the parasite in the Gulf of Mexico infecting blue crabs there isn't also in the Chesapeake Bay, right?
So there are limited reports of infected blue crabs. I only know of a handful where we see blue crabs infected by a similar species throughout the Atlantic coast. If anybody ever sees this parasite on the abdomen of blue crabs, let people know that that is out there for sure.
What does it look like?
So if anybody is familiar with blue crabs in general, and when they have sponges or eggs on their abdomen, it looks very similar to that. It's a mass on the abdomen of the crab. You pull down the abdomen or the telson, and it's a very large bulbous mass. To me, it looks like a deflated old apple, but that's definitely not a good way to describe it.
Hey, I like it. I can picture that. Yeah. Do you ever think during the time of COVID and coronavirus about the similarities between the parasite in us as humans and the parasite you're studying in the crabs?
Yeah, so there are some similarities, but there are also some important differences. So the coronavirus is a virus, and obviously what we're talking about is definitely an animal. The way that they infect their hosts are similar, right? They're injecting material into both hosts and using host cells in order to help them reproduce. So similarity is in that way, but there are very distinct differences, I think.
And there is no way for us to help the crab shed the parasite, right?
No, unfortunately not. I mean, once they are infected, they continue to be infected until the crab dies.
Are you seeing an increase in percentage of crab infected by the parasite, or is this a very, very slow evolution?
Yeah, that's a really fascinating question, and something that we actually study in our lab. The crab and the parasite have different tolerances to salinity. And what we notice in the Chesapeake Bay is that in low salinities, you don't have any parasitism in the crabs. In high salinities, you do. So depending on where you are in the bay, you can have upwards of 90% infection of the individuals that you look at. And then other areas can be completely devoid of parasites. So there's very large difference in terms of parasitism rates, we think, related to salinity.
That's so interesting. And where is salinity high in a bay? Is it in deeper water?
Yeah, in general, like in the bay, in the main stem of the bay, it would be much more saline, also close to the mouth of the bay. And then, you know, of course, the Chesapeake Bay has lots of different river systems off of the bay. And as you go up the river system, you obviously get a change in salinity.
So how do you think this affects the food chain? Does the parasite shorten the life of the crab, or can it go on? And who feeds on these tiny mud crabs?
So these mud crabs are really tiny, and I think in general they are underappreciated for their roles in the ecosystem because they provide a very important trophic link between kind of primary producers and various, you know, small organisms, but then they're a prey item for larger species like fish and birds. The other thing I didn't mention is that once these crabs are parasitized, the parasite stops the molting cycle of the crab, which means that the crabs can't grow. And so this, we think, has a huge implication on the longevity of the crabs.
So it ultimately kills it, really?
Yeah, definitely. Because you got to think about it. You've got this thing inside you that's sucking up all of your nutrients, right? You are a vessel to make sure that the parasite reproduces its babies. So once you are sucked up of all your nutrients, right?
So if this other parasite is in the blue crabs in the Gulf of Mexico, has that crashed the blue crab population there?
This particular group that we're talking about, this host parasite mud crab population, where they co-evolve in the Gulf of Mexico, where they've been there for millions of years together, you have really low incidence of parasitism rates because they either have some mechanism to avoid infection, either a behavioral mechanism or an immune response or something like that to actually...
You mean the crabs there are avoiding infection?
Exactly. And so if you go out in the wild, those infection rates are only between 5 and 15%. But in the Chesapeake Bay, like I mentioned, upwards of 90% of infection or populations are infected. So in the Chesapeake Bay, because the host and parasite have not co-evolved for a long period of time, the host, the crab host, doesn't recognize it and doesn't know how to evade it. In the Gulf of Mexico, the blue crabs also have a really low incidence rate of parasitism because they've been co-evolved. If that parasite that infects the blue crabs finds its way to the Chesapeake Bay, we could have an instance where 90% of our blue crab populations are infected because those hosts don't recognize the parasite as a parasite and don't have a mechanism to avoid infection. And that's what we're worried about.
And does it hurt us if we eat an infected crab?
That's a great question too. You can always think of as these parasites as extra protein if you'd like to. Once you eat, because most people, when they're eating a blue crab, for instance, they're going to cook it, right? And once you do that, not only are you killing the crab, but you're also killing the parasite inside. So even if you ate a raw blue crab, which I don't know how you would, first of all, how you would do that, and secondly, why you would do that. But even if you were to do that, you would not be a viable host for this parasite.
Well, Amy Fowler, you're doing fascinating work. Thank you for talking with me, and with good reason.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure.
Amy Fowler is a professor of environmental science and policy at George Mason University. Abandoned battlefields can be creepy, but they're also often some of the most preserved ecosystems around. Not only can you find war relics, but you can find native species that have mostly disappeared elsewhere. Todd Lookingbill is a professor of geography at the University of Richmond. He says battlefields have an untapped value for people, spiritually and physically. Todd, how did you come to start thinking about battlefields as these vibrant ecological places? It's not where most of us go when we think of former battlefields.
So I came at this from a background of studying actually old growth forests in the Western Cascades of Oregon. So about two decades ago, I kind of moved to this Mid-Atlantic region. And what I found was a lot of battlefield sites, and I've come to appreciate through time their value from a conservation perspective as well.
How many former battlefield sites are there in America?
So hundreds, right? So just Civil War battlefields,
there's something like 380 kind of recognized Civil War battlefield sites. The U.S. National Park Service recognizes 25 national battlefield units, national battlefield sites. But a lot of these sites are protected by a state, and those include a range from Civil War to other types of battles. But a lot of these sites aren't protected by the our federal government, but by state agencies and even kind of private public partnerships. So the numbers in the thousands. There's Gettysburg is probably the first site that jumps to people's minds. And there's over a million visitors a year to Gettysburg. But there's lots of Antietam in Maryland, another kind of pretty famous one, the site of the single largest loss of life in U.S. military history. But then we have sites in the Ohio region and the Texas and the Southwest. Kind of we have a bunch of forts related to kind of colonial kind of expansion and defense. There's some battlefield sites in the West, as far west as kind of California, in the Southwest. And if you expand your definition of battlefields to landscapes of war, I don't think there's a state in the Union that doesn't have a relevant site.
15 years ago, you were working at one of these Civil War sites in Virginia called the Manassas National Battlefield, and they are undergoing an attempt to rethink what they should look like. Should they look like the battlefield where all those lives were lost, or should they stay the way they've become now?
Yeah, Manassas was the site of two Civil War battles, one of which was the battle in which Stonewall Jackson famously got his moniker, that as a there stands Jackson like a stone wall, as the Northern troops were kind of advancing against his line and they were defending it. And in the 150 years subsequent to that battle, that field that was the charge was led across had grown into a forest, as fields will do if left to their own devices. And the park was, you know, really keeping in mind this mandate to have the park look like what it did at the time of that conflict. And so they were going to clear that field, remove all the trees from it. And so just got in working with them, think about, well, what are the implications of clearing a forest? You know, this is now a regenerated kind of forest with trees that is you know, 100 years old or so. Like, what's going to happen if we remove that patch of land? Will it isolate some species into the remaining fragments of forest, where there'll be wetlands that are adjacent to those forests that will dry up because of what's known as edge effects by getting more sunlight kind of into the adjacent forest? Just thinking a little bit more broadly, not privileging ecological or kind of the history component, but just thinking about the multiple different types of values that these sites can bring.
What did they end up doing?
They cut. But they did.
No, they did?
Yes, but they did end up modifying the cut to, there was some wetlands with some northern two-line salamanders that we thought were important to kind of protect. And so they did modify the cut a little bit, and they did try to kind of make sure that they didn't kind of isolate fragments as much as possible. So the cut happened, which was important from a historical perspective, but it took into mind some ecological kind of change alterations. And importantly, they also kind of continued to monitor the potential impacts to some of the wildlife kind of in that area to see if there were adverse consequences of the cut.
I'm curious, did it hurt your heart that they cut?
I wasn't surprised, I guess I will say that.
And the other
part of it is, in some ways, fields are a more endangered ecosystem. Natural fields are a more endangered ecosystem in this area of the world than forests. Because of where these battles took place, largely on the periphery of cities, they've become heavily suburbanized in the outskirts around them. And if we actually have done a study in the parks around Washington, D.C., that shows if you're comparing the land in the parks to the land immediately adjacent to the parks using satellite imagery, the parks have about 20 to 40% more forest and fields than the areas around them. And the fields actually are what are really disappearing and turning into people's neighborhoods and so forth. There was more agriculture in that region and so forth. So, you know, turning so producing more kind of field, if it's managed in a way that can promote grassland birds, for example, isn't the worst thing in the world.
You know, the great biologist and environmentalist E.O. Wilson, who just died in December, tried to persuade nations of the world to set aside half of the earth to be preserved for species and nature. Were you a fan of his idea of that?
I couldn't be a bigger fan. And it's encouraging to see how that ambitious proposal and statement has grown legs. We see that in the current administration advocating for this 30 by 30 initiative. So not half, but restoring 30% of the U.S.'s lands and waters and protecting those lands, setting those aside. And that's not just a U.S. initiative. That's actually a global, a 30 by 30 initiative is a global initiative. And a lot of those efforts globally tend to be dedicated to protecting exotic tropical lands in Patagonia and the Amazon, which is super important, don't get me wrong. But I think we could be doing more kind of locally, and we're going to need to be more creative kind of about what kinds of lands we want to protect in order to meet that goal. I think these battlefields or landscapes of war offer that opportunity to kind of think more holistically about conservation. And we use the term collateral values for this protection effort, meaning that it may not be the primary reason we're kind of protecting Manassas National Battlefield because of the amazing bluebirds that can be found in the grasslands there. But you know, thinking about the analogy of collateral damages from war, there's these maybe unintended, but the consequences, but we do have these values that appear related to the wildlife that gets protected if we kind of do set these lands aside. So maybe we should be more intentional about the historical and natural value of these lands, and that will make them even more, it will help with the conservation efforts, help set them aside. I think of kind of two purposes for recognizing the natural amenities, the natural values of these sites. One was about improving the management of them, but the second is to make them more likely to be protected in the future, to contribute to these efforts like Half Earth, that E.O. Wilson kind of initiative.
Describe some of the ways these federal lands or former federal lands have evolved now that they've been sort of fallow for decades, that people can use them more and species have returned.
There's a natural progression that these lands tend to go through. And this isn't a U.S. specific, but it starts, you know, soon after the conflict is over, in which people, oftentimes soldiers and their families, kind of return to these sites. Thinking about Antietam National Battlefield in Maryland, kind of the first phase of memorializing that site happened almost immediately upon Lee's army retreat across the Potomac. And then as people started burying the dead. And then on the fifth anniversary of that battle, a cemetery was dedicated. And as that time passes, that's when we see the conservation and protection kind of came in. The Antietam was first protected kind of by the U.S. War Department, and then as it was no longer useful as a place of strategy and as some of the soldiers started to pass away, it was handed over to the National Park Service. And I think that's a natural evolution. And then so people start coming in for different purposes. And so now we see more visitors at many of these sites from local neighbors walking their dogs as much as people coming to kind of view the history of the site.
How do people use the site? In addition to knowing it's more beautiful and it's a great place to take a walk, there must be other ways that people interact with that more natural space.
Sure. So I worked on a book with a colleague here, Peter Smallwood, in which we catalog dozens of these benefits that these sites provide to people, which describes how people use these sites. Birders really kind of bought into this idea earlier on. Wildflower watching, nature photography, but you can also think about the increased property value to neighbors that these parks provide. the way they regulate climate by having just additional green space in these oftentimes urbanizing or suburbanizing landscape. They protect native and rare plants and animals. Their spiritual retreat, purify water and air. There's a whole bunch of different ecosystem services provided by these landscapes.
What are you noticing when you talk about this with your students? Mass extinctions, preservation of natural areas, efforts to reclaim the beauty and the importance and the multiple species of nature. Where are your students on this? Indifferent or passionate?
Passionate. And keep in mind, I teach in a geography and environmental studies program, so there is some self-selecting there, but I also teach in the general education program, so I think, you know, I can speak for the larger student body that we interact with. And this is at the forefront of their minds when they come, when they start at university. They're well aware of this sixth mass extinction event that is going on right now. They want to do something about it. I think the time for just talking is, even in their lives, is already something that's passing, and they're looking for actions and solutions and ways to protect lands and wildlife, protect wildlife, in the same way they're looking to combat climate change.
Todd Lookingbill is an associate professor of geography and the environment at the University of Richmond. He's been named an outstanding faculty member by the State Council of Higher Education for Virginia. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. Welcome back to With Good Reason from Virginia Humanities. Human land development isn't always bad for animals. By chopping down and fragmenting the forest, we're unintentionally creating ideal habitats for deer.
And I have stopped growing anything because the deer eat everything I plant, including hot peppers. I'm still perplexed about that.
Right. Matthias Liu is an associate professor